Hello, this is Robert Rickover. I'm an Alexander Technique teacher in Lincoln, Nebraska, and in Toronto, Canada. And today I'm having a conversation with Mike Cross, who's an Alexander Technique teacher in Aylesbury, England. That's between Oxford and London. And we're going to talk today about the two Marjories of the Alexander Technique world, Marjorie Barlow and Marjorie Barstow. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Robert.
Both of the Marjories trained with F. Matthias Alexander in the 1930s. I believe they were on the course together, at least at some point. I'm not 100% sure of that.
Yes, Marjorie Barlow told me that she regarded Marjorie Barstow a bit like an older sister, because Marjorie Barstow started a year before Marjorie, mm-hmm. and Marjorie Barlow was only 17 when she began.
That's right. She was very young, and Marjorie Barstow was in her early 30s at that point.
And so Marjorie Barstow sort of took Marjorie Barlow under her wing, was the way she told me about it, I think.
Right. And Marjorie Barlow was the niece of F. Matthias Alexander. Marjorie Barstow, who came from Lincoln, Nebraska, and was certainly an outlier geographically on that first training course, was in fact the first person to sign up for the course, and I believe the first person to qualify. Marjorie Barlow spent most of her teaching life in London, I believe, right?
Yeah. On that point, though, Robert, I think it's important to recognize that Irene Tasker and the likes of the people who were apprentices to FM, who didn't actually qualify on the training course, but were in the work. In fact, Marjorie's own mother helped FM in his teaching, I think, when they first came over from Australia.
Yes, the history is that Alexander sort of informally trained a number of people to teach, and then in I think 1931 he established the first training course in London, and the two Marjories were both students on that first training course. So Marjorie Barlow spent most of her teaching career in London. She was married to Dr. Wilford Barlow, who's probably at least as well known as her in Alexander circles. Marjorie Barstow, on the other hand, lived most of her life back here in Lincoln, Nebraska, and did not achieve any sort of significant level of recognition until she was in her 70s, at which point she suddenly became very well known in the Alexander world, and huge numbers of people came here to Lincoln to take workshops with her, and she also traveled extensively around the states and around the world. One thing I think we should say before we get into the discussion about these two women is that we, Mike and I, do not speak for them. We were both students of them. That is, I was a student of Marjorie Barstow and Mike a student of Marjorie Barlow. I never had any lessons with Marjorie Barlow, and Mike has not had any with Marjorie Barstow. But I think there's some similarities and some interesting differences between their approach to teaching. And Mike, I'd like to start with your first impression of Marjorie Barlow.
Well, I never knew Marjorie Barlow as a student in the sort of the technical sense that we call students, trainee teachers of the technique students. And so I knew her as her pupil, really. And all the lessons she gave me were really like almost that she was giving a pupil a first lesson. It was always right back to the beginning, working on the table. And she always seemed to teach every lesson as if I knew nothing, which probably wasn't that far from the truth and probably still isn't. But my actual first impression of her was I come from Birmingham originally. And when I came back from Japan in 1995 with a view to training in the technique, I stayed in Birmingham, And just by luck, the Conference of STAT, the Society of Teachers of the Alexander Technique, had their meeting in Birmingham in the summer of 95, and Marjorie was giving the keynote address. So that was the first time I set eyes on her. That talk was actually written up in the STAT News and the STAT Journal. My impression was of a very feisty 8-year-old lady speaking very, very clearly, with a kind of a clear mission to transmit to her audience exactly in clear terms what FM meant by thinking. That was the title of the talk, Thinking. And a couple of years later, after I'd been 2 years doing the teacher training, I plucked up the courage to go down to London for a lesson with Marjorie. And of course, I say I plucked up the courage because I was very much in the mode of trying to be right. And as soon as I walked into Marjorie's teaching room, I felt in retrospect that she had my number right from the beginning. And she did spend an awful lot of time emphasizing the point that being wrong is the best friend we've got in the work. And so
And
then
could
from
you say a little bit about that, what that means in a little more detail? Being wrong is your best friend.
Well, in preparation for doing this interview, Robert, I just reviewed a nice DVD we've got of that Michael Fredericks took for the Stony Brook Conference in New York in 1986. And Marjorie herself kind of clarifies on that it's about making the wrong conscious. That if we can actually do the wrong thing consciously, there's nothing to lose. We can stop doing it. And so that's how I understand it, making the wrong thing conscious. And when we talk about what the wrong thing is, the wrong thing is trying to be right, or the wrong thing has a lot to do with fear, what FM called unduly excited fear reflexes and emotions. And so that's been my, just as you said, I can't speak for how Marjorie would answer your question, but I can tell you how I've responded to her teaching, and it has been to try and be more clear about what the wrong thing is. And that kind of working things out for myself has led me to think that the problem of what FM called unduly excited fear reflexes and emotions is very much tied up with the fear of being wrong and the associated desire to be right. Marjorie used to say there's no such thing, no such animal as being right, was the phrase she used. What does that does
Yeah,
that
I think
give
that'd be
you
a
a
let that's a great start. And maybe this would be a good time for me to share my initial
That's what I
take
was going to ask, yes.
on Marge Barstow.
Sure.
It's interesting that Marjorie Barlow was around 80 when you first met her. Marjorie Barstow was also 80, 79 or 80 when I first met her. She was what I had heard about her when I was training in England was that she worked with groups, and I was very interested in that because at the time the whole idea of working with groups was pretty controversial in London, and there was a great deal of discussion and argument, and a lot of nasty comments were being tossed back and forth on that topic. And I thought, wow, if this woman's working with groups, I'd like to see how she does it. And so I went to a winter workshop of hers in Lincoln, Nebraska. I was pretty much halfway through my training course in London at the time, and I had no idea what to expect. I was a little bit terrified about the weather situation because it was in late December, early January, and my image of Nebraska was huge snowstorms with cattle up to their eyeballs in ice and hay being flown in by the National Guard, which is kind of what we used to see on movies or newsreels about this part of the country. But as it turned out, the weather was fine. And Marjorie, when I first met her, I was just struck by her face was that of an 80-year-old. But when you saw her walking, for example, if you were behind her when she was walking, she looked like she was in her 30s. And she had incredible stamina. We our workshops went from 9 in the morning, I believe, until 4 in the afternoon with maybe an hour off for lunch for 14 days straight. Sundays, New Year's Day, none of it made any difference. We just were working away. And right away, I could see that she... It took me a few days to really get what she was doing, because in some ways it was very different from the standard teaching I had been used to in England. But I could see that she was absolutely true to Alexander's principles, but she had developed a different way of conveying those ideas, and a very effective way. And the thing that surprised me the most initially, because there were about 25 people on this workshop, which was a relatively small one for her, and I figured she's going to be spending her whole time moving around, getting her hands on people because there were so many people and she only had two hands. But in fact, she used her hands very sparingly, even when she was working with an individual in front of the group. It was not a whole lot of hands-on work. What there was of it was incredible, very, very powerful stuff. But it was clear to me that she was getting people to, possibly in a different way from Marjorie Barlow, but she was getting people to really start thinking. The other thing that was interesting was she drew no distinction in these workshops between someone who'd never heard of the technique before and teachers of many years' experience. We were all treated exactly the same. And someone walking in wouldn't have no way of knowing who was a teacher and who was an absolute beginner. And I was very impressed with that way of working. And I left after 2 weeks... absolutely certain that this is the lady I wanted to study with as much as possible. I certainly wanted to finish my training in England. I love that as well. But I knew that Marge was going to be my main teacher from then on.
So you relocated to Nebraska for that reason, did you?
Well, not initially, no. I when I finished my training, I moved back to Toronto where I had been living. But I made a point of going to as many of her workshops as I could. She actually came to Toronto a few times. She had regular workshops in Lincoln, and occasionally I would go other places where she was teaching. And it was only when she retired from traveling, when she was 91, she decided she wanted to not be on the road 7 months a year. That's when I thought, well, I'll move to Lincoln and set up workshops for her here in Lincoln, which I did. So that's why I moved here, because it seemed like an incredible opportunity, and it certainly was in ways I never would have expected.
Well, from what you said at the beginning there, Robert, I'm struck more by the similarities rather than by any difference. And let me just sort of explain why. First of all, about thinking, that was always Marjorie's big emphasis, that the teacher's job is to get the student thinking, particularly what she would say, to think about how to work on oneself, to think what you're doing in working on yourself. And she only taught me in the context of one-to-one in her teaching room, her teaching me on the table mainly. But sometimes, even then, she would sit in a chair next to the table without putting hands on, and just talk me through the process of inhibiting and directing, and moving a leg. So at those times she wouldn't be putting hands on. She'd just be using her voice.
Yeah, and Marjorie Barstow would often just speak. I mean, she would use her hands when it seemed appropriate, but as you say, they were both feisty old women who really wanted people to start thinking for themselves, and they weren't terribly patient with people who were not prepared to do that. Marge could be pretty tough on people who were expecting her to fix them, for example. She could be pretty caustic about that. I think an interesting thing to discuss might be their approach to inhibition, inhibition in the Alexander sense of the word, not the Freudian sense. I did attend a talk that Marjorie Barlow gave in England when I was on the training course. And she specifically talked about inhibition, as I remember, and her analogy, which at the time I was very struck by and very impressed by, was that inhibition is a little like neutral on a gear shift of a car. We're talking not automatic transmission so much, but a regular transmission, that when you go from first gear into reverse, you have to pass through a place where you're doing nothing, which is neutral. And her analogy was that neutral was a bit like inhibition, in the sense that it was a little space in which to reorganize your thinking, say no to what you don't want, and then direct yourself in a new way. Something along those lines. I'm just paraphrasing her right now.
Well, as you do that, I'm reflecting on what I said about Marjorie not putting hands on. And I realize that people will hear that and they won't hear it as I meant it. Because, of course, Marjorie was using her hands all the time in giving a table turn. And she thought the use of the hands was tremendously important. But it's just I wanted to emphasize that it wasn't the be all and end all, it was secondary. The use of the hands was to speed up the teaching process. But if I try to represent what Marjorie's views on inhibition were in this interview, I can kind of see her sitting there shaking her head, saying, "No, that's not what I meant." That's the danger, isn't it? But it's like that. It's like that Sufi story of the five blind men and the elephants. That one puts his hand on and feels his, says it's like a wall. Another one puts hands on and says like it's like a tree trunk. You know that story?
They're each getting a little part of something.
Exactly. If I say, well, Marjorie's views on inhibition were like that, I'm doubtless going to be talking about just the tail or the trunk or something. But what I can tell you with confidence is what I took to be the practice of inhibition, as she taught it to me. And that was very clearly had to do with the business of not moving a leg. Because on a lying on the table, she would spend a few minutes getting me in a more or less directed state, encouraging me to say no to trying to be right, to say no to doing the directions, and then she would say, "Now lift up your right foot, stretch out your right leg, and put it down on the table." And that's where I really learned what she meant by inhibition, because as the lessons went by, I got more and more confident in really, really giving up the idea of moving the leg. So, you say we're going to neutral, it's like doing nothing. But Marjorie sometimes would make a joke and say, "I put hands on and think of doing nothing." Then I ask myself, "What kind of nothing am I doing?" And it was that kind of situation that I gradually realised that I hadn't really given up the idea of moving the leg. The saying no that she was asking for was really saying no to any idea of doing anything.
That's yeah, and that and it's interesting that Marjorie Barlow taught you, at least, about inhibition in the context of a table lesson. Marjorie Barstow, by the time I met her, virtually never worked with people on the table. She would on very, very rare occasions. Her orientation in teaching was working with individuals in a group setting, and working also the other thing that really distinguished her teaching from most of what was going on in England at the time was working with people in activities. She would just ask people what they wanted to do, and she would work with whatever they had chosen. And in that context, I can remember very clearly a class where there possibly were 100, 125 people, and Marge, who by that time had shrunk a bit because she had pretty severe osteoporosis. And at some point in the middle of this large class, someone raises his hand and says, "Marge, I noticed that you never you don't ever talk about inhibition. You don't ever use that word."
Yeah.
And of course, the rest of us who were sitting there who knew Marge were whenever anyone asked a question like that, we were on the edge of our seats waiting to hear what the answer would be.
Yeah.
Because we knew that it would be an interesting one. And there was a very long pause, and you could see the wheels turning in her head, because when she came up with an answer, she wasn't just directing it at that one person, that she was aware there was a large group. And what she ended up saying was, inhibition, that's all that I teach. And then she went on to say something to the effect, well, what is inhibition? It's not doing the thing you don't want to do. And if you're doing something else or thinking something else, then you're not thinking the thing you don't want to be thinking. So it was a very different view than Marjorie Barlow. And I would say it's different in some ways. It's the same in others. And the analogy that I came up with was that, and this is mine, not Marjorie Barstow's, that her view of inhibition was sort of like if you're driving along a highway and you realize that you're going in the wrong direction, you've made a mistake in terms of direction, what do you do at that point? Well, typically on an American highway, if it's not an interstate, you pull over to the side into an extra lane on the side, and then you make a U-turn and you're back going the other way. Now, it's entirely possible that at some point you will come to a complete stop before you make the U-turn. Certainly if there's traffic on the road, you wait for a break in it. But not necessarily. You might just pull over, turn, and off you're going the other way, and there is no complete stopping as, you know, neutral in a gear shift.
Yeah.
And you know, it's a different approach, and it comes out of a different kind of set of teaching experiences, I think, and a different orientation towards teaching. But to me, that was her take on inhibition. It was a more of a dynamic, perhaps, dynamic idea of inhibition.
Well, I mean, what Marjorie... I doubt very much whether you're going to say this is the difference in Marjorie Barstow's approach. I bet my bottom dollar they were both asking this same question, was how did FM solve his problem?
Yes.
That's what... If there's any confusion about... Because when you use metaphors like... the metaphor about going to neutral is not one that I remember, but, it can be problematic to associate Marjorie's practice of inhibition with something she might have said, fluidly in a presentation. But what she was always interested in was how did FM solve his problem?
I should say that is also was also Marjorie Barstow's interest, and in fact, she would drive us nuts by going on and on about how important it was to read that first chapter in Use of the Self. And she would say that she would read that over and over again. And she would encourage her students to read little sections of it as an activity in class. And She often said that, in her view, one of the most important sentences in that for that chapter, Evolution of a Technique, was where Alexander says, "And I tried all kinds of other things that are too numerous to mention," or something to that effect. And she said he tried all sorts of stuff, and in line with your statement earlier, our best friend is
Being
mistakes or
wrong.
being wrong. Marge would totally identify with that. Don't be afraid to make mistakes. Do experiments. She was very much in an experimental mode. She encouraged people to try things. Try this, try that, you know. Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid to tense your neck. It's not going to hurt you. She would say, she'd get up in front of a group and someone would ask her about slouching, for example, and she'd go into a little slouch and she'd say, "You know, sometimes I just feel like a little slouch." Now, her slouch was pretty subtle, I have to say. And then she said, "Well, and after a while, I might get tired of that and I'll just come out of it gently," and she would come out of it. So she never, it was, there was never an idea that you had to be right all the time
Well,
or that
this is it.
that's what you were striving for.
The kind of problem you said at the beginning with people saying, "Oh, well, Marjorie Barr, so she does this, that, and that's not, that can't be right." I mean, really, that is coming from a place of trying to be right, isn't it? It's, you know, our way is the right way. Her way is off the authentic path. So, it, you know, my own sort of view on it, having been a bit like that at the beginning, wanting to find which way was the right one, the McDonald way of doing it, you know, have the legs apart, the legs close together. I mean, as I've gone on through the years, I can't see that there's any difference to speak of in the absolute essence of the thing. For that very reason, because the essence is just as you've expressed it there. The essence has to do with trying everything out and finding out what works. The
Yeah, I
essence.
mean it, the various teachers, we're talking about the two Marjories, but of course there are some other famous first generation, I guess, or second, I don't know, I guess second generation, whatever, people like Walter Carrington and Patrick MacDonald, all of whom had fairly different styles of teaching, used different procedures to teach. But I do think it's fair to say they were all teaching the same thing, the same basic principles.
Well, Elizabeth Walker is another one.
Elizabeth
Elizabeth Walker,
Walker, yes,
she lives
absolutely.
just close to us in Oxford. And Elizabeth always emphasizes that we should be able to learn from you know, anybody in any of the streams.
Right. I think an interesting thing in talking about the two Marjories, we've talked a little about inhibition, but another basic Alexander technique concept is direction or conscious control, those terms. And I think that Marjorie Barstow did evolve a slightly different different wording for directions than are common among, let's say, most Alexander Technique teachers. And the difference is she never claimed that her wording was better than others, but she just said, "I find this works a little better for me." And instead of the more or less standard directions that I think most Alexander teachers and students will be familiar with, something along the lines of "my neck to be free," or "I'm letting my neck be free," "to let my head move forward and up," "to let my back lengthen and widen." Other things could be tacked on to that. Marjorie Barstow tended to use words something along the lines of "I'm letting my head," and she would often emphasize "my whole head," release very, very delicately away from my torso. She used the word torso a lot, and I'm allowing my torso to move with it. And then when it came to the legs, she would often say, particularly in walking, she would say, and the legs just kind of tag along. They fit in somehow. Now, I spent a lot of time analyzing those words on her part, partly from a kind of an NLP perspective in terms of how many memory slots do we have available for directing, if because we need, according to a lot of research, we can only keep 7 ± 2 ideas going at any one time in our mind, and some of them have to be very practical things like, to do with living. And it seemed to me that Marjorie Barstow figured out a way of reducing the number of things to think about. So head moving away from my torso and my torso following very gently is maybe one or two things less than I'm letting my neck be free so that my head can move forward, my head can move up or forward and up, and my back can lengthen and widen. There were sort of more things. And but as I say, she didn't, Marjorie Barstow never said the other directions weren't. She said those were Alexander's directions and they work great, and I've just found some that seem to work a little better in my own teaching. And she was
Well,
so she,
that's interesting. But here is, I think, possibly one difference that I've picked up between Marjorie Barstow and Marjorie Barlow. By looking at Marjorie Barstow in her old age and hearing a history, I think Marjorie Barstow was a woman of very, very good coordination, because I mean she picked up things much quicker than people on the first training course, from what I've heard. She was always a little bit ahead of the game, you know. So even after 3 years, she was ready to go back to America.
Right.
Does
She,
that make sense?
yeah, I actually, I think the history is, well, she had gone over to England earlier in the early 20s and spent a half a year there with her sister, and her went over and they studied with Alexander, and then when Alexander started his training course, she was on the boat right away back to England. And Alexander felt that she was qualified after 3 years. I think the other people on the course, most of them stayed on for 4. Now, Marjorie Barstow also then worked as Alexander's brother's assistant in Boston and New York for several years in the after the training course. And by the way, she had an extremely high regard for Alexander's brother, A.R. Alexander. And we could never sort of draw her out into a discussion about the differences between them, but
Well, so did Marjorie. She learned a lot from A.R.
she
Alexander as well.
Marjorie Barstow, yeah, both Marjories felt that A.R., in his own right, was a superb teacher. And possibly because he had to learn it from his brother, was in a slightly better position in some ways to teach it to other people. Who knows? But certainly, A.R. Alexander was a major, major influence on both Marjories.
But here's the difference I wanted to bring out there, Robert. I'm guessing that Marjorie Barstow was naturally a well-coordinated child that had done lots of crawling and been put on a tummy and, grown up on the farm and been very healthy. Marjorie Barlow spent most of her childhood in bed, ill, and she never crawled. That's a big thing if you think developmentally. So here's why I think, because it was no question about it. When lying on Marjorie Barlow's teaching table, it was free your neck, let the head go forward and up, let the spine lengthen and the back widen, sending the knees up to the ceiling. Those four, and the fourth one was never tacked on at the end. It was absolutely part of those big four directions. Let the neck be free, to let the head go forward and up. So it was really always clearly forward and up, because Marjorie, she hated it when people garbled the directions. Let neck free, head forward. No, let the neck be free, to let the head go forward and up, to let the spine lengthen and the back widen, sending the knees up to the ceiling. So sometimes the words would change, but those four, that it was four directions. And so there's one of Marjorie's things was the difference between thinking, in other words, thinking the orders to let the neck be free, to let the head go forward and up, to let the spine lengthen and the back widen, sending the knees up to the ceiling. That's what she meant by thinking or giving orders, those four. And she drew a very clear distinction to me between thinking and thinking about stuff, because my tendency is very strongly to be trying to work things out, you know, to discuss things, to try and get my head around things. And so, you know, that was every lesson she would be tugging me back like a dog on the lead to come back to thinking and not into intellectual abstract thinking.
Well, I would say, just to interrupt for a moment, Marjorie Barstow was about as unabstract a person as you could ever meet. And when people started getting into abstract discussions, particularly anything to do with the Alexander technique, she would get exasperated. And I remember at least one time her saying, after some back and forth about various abstract ideas of what the technique was or whatever, she would say, "You people, you don't want to believe how simple it is." She really had no patience for abstractions. She was an incredibly practical, down-to-earth person.
I heard the quote where she said, "I'm too practical to be alive," or something like that,
Yes,
was it?
that's one of her quotes. And I think it's interesting. I didn't know that about Marjorie Barlow, that she grew up, her childhood, she was ill in bed for a period of time. I don't know the details of Marjorie Barstow's early childhood. She didn't actually grow up on a farm. Her father was one of the richest people around in Lincoln, and she grew up in her father was a banker and entrepreneur of various kinds. She grew up in a huge house that it was built in 1901 and that she was still living in when she died in 1995. So she but I would she I'm sure she was very, very coordinated. In fact, her initial training was in dance. She ran a dance studio here in Lincoln before she went over to England to train to be a teacher. And she also, another influence on her teaching, which probably is not true for Marjorie Barlow, is that she was very interested in horses, training horses, riding horses. She spent a lot of time on a ranch that she owned outside of town. She was riding well into her 80s. And I think some of her ideas actually came from observing horses and training horses. It influenced a little bit her approach to teaching in some ways. You know, there's another difference that we haven't really directly addressed. I'm sure this is probably a strong difference between the two Marjories. That is actually, I think, a difference between Marjorie Barstow and pretty much most other Alexander teachers, which involves this question of directing as a thought rather than actually doing something. So non-doing ideas that so I think a lot of teachers, when they teach students directions, say, "Now you're just to think the thought. You're not to actually do anything to make your intent happen." On the other hand, Marjorie Barstow would often say to people, "Well, move your head, move it." Now, it took me a long time to reconcile those two, especially when I first met Marjorie Barstow. And the person that whose writing helped me in a way to really clarify that initially was Patrick MacDonald, who, when he talks about directing, says something to the effect in one of his little pamphlets, and I don't have the exact words, that there is a movement. It's just a very tiny movement.
Yeah.
Extremely tiny movement. And
well, Marjorie Barlow spoke to me about that. A.R. Alexander apparently used to say that, well, of course directing is a doing, but it's a doing below the sensory register. I think I've quoted that correctly.
Oh, that's interesting. So what I think is that
Marjorie added to that. She said, yes, he did say that, but it was a very dangerous thing to say.
Well,
so she didn't contradict it, but her big thing with directions was not doing them, because you know we're also liable to sort of try to implement them, try to organise and arrange ourselves in some way, and I certainly am not immune from that. So that was always the emphasis that I picked up was let the neck be free. No, don't do it. You can't do an undoing. Mm-hmm. You know that was the phrase that came again and again. You cannot do an undoing.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree that's a dangerous area, and I think Marjorie kind of stepped into that dangerous area very consciously, and her approach was that when she would say to someone, well, move your head, or your head is moving delicately away from your torso, she used the word delicately a lot, and her hands would reinforce that message. She was kind of coming at this very tiny, subtle movement from the direction of, yes, it's a movement, but it's a very subtle one. Whereas I think the standard Alexander teaching method, not just Marjorie Barlow, but probably most other teachers, is to say it's not a movement, it's just a thought. But of course, a thought cannot just be a thought. A thought is always a movement because that's just how we're wired up. You can't disentangle a thought from a movement. And I think Marjorie Barstow came at it more from, yeah, it's a movement, but we got to be very careful about what kind of a movement it is, whereas the standard approach is just think it. Just think something. Yeah. And that's a big difference. And it took me, that was one of the most shocking things, actually, when I first met Marge, was she would tell people to move their heads. And I remember having huge discussions with her about that, because that seemed to go against everything that I had ever learned about the technique on my training course and from other teachers. But at the same time, it was obvious that this was actually useful the way she was doing it. People weren't overdoing. People were making really interesting changes in their use and functioning. And so it took me somewhat longer to reconcile those two ideas intellectually, but that is a very important distinction, probably maybe in some ways the biggest distinction between the two women.
Well, I don't recognize that, Robert. I think we see distinctions sometimes. If we get into the problem of words, you know, I think all people who've the first generation ones who really made the work their own were struggling to find the words. Yeah, Marjorie used to say that FM would say that words have got barnacles on them. You know, the word thinking has got the barnacles attached to it,
mm-hmm.
and movement also has barnacles attached to it. I mean, FM himself, in the evolution of a technique, he said he put the head forward and up, didn't he?
Mm-hmm.
You know, he deliberately used that phrase. He put the head forward and up. So I think the difference is more in one of words, because with Marjorie's hands on my head, there would be a sense sometimes that she was pulling the head out, you know, as a movement, and I could feel it from my tailbone, and so it was the head was being pulled out. You could say the head was moving away from the tailbone. That wouldn't be a false description of it.
Mm-hmm. But it may have been that she wasn't pulling, but she was just thinking, and that was taking it in the upward direction.
Exactly, she was thinking out, and it was moving out. But so I don't think there's any difference there.
Well, I don't think there's a fundamental difference. I think when I said that's a perhaps I overused the word major distinction, but it is a very different way for a beginning student to encounter the two Marjories. I think they would be given significantly different verbal descriptions. Hopefully, they would both end up achieving the same basic understanding of Alexander's ideas. And another thing that's kind of interesting in this context is Marge would often say when she was teaching a group or teaching people, she'd say, "Well, when I put my hands on you, I'm doing your thinking for you. That's what I'm doing." And she made it very clear that she wasn't about to continue doing that indefinitely. She would do it if when it seemed necessary, but she did it in order to show you exactly what she meant by the words she was using. And her hands were, as I'm sure you could see from all those YouTube videos, I mean, they were extraordinary. Both women, I'm sure, show you what can happen if you spend, what, I suppose, 60 odd years thinking about experimenting with Alexander's ideas. That some pretty amazing things come out from that process in terms of ability to help people. You know, one other thing that I wanted to just mention, you talked about words having barnacles attached to them. There is nobody who was more aware of that than F.M. Alexander himself. I mean, he, in his writing, he often says, "Well, I'm going to use," for example, in one of his books, he says, "I'm going to use the word mental sometimes in this chapter and physical sometimes, but I want that to be understood that when I say mental, I mean there's more mental than physical. It's relatively more mental. And when I say physical, I don't mean to imply there's not any mental activity going on, but there's perhaps more obviously physical activity." And he coined the phrase psychophysical, which to indicate very clearly that you could not really disentangle the two. But he was very aware of words, and he addresses that whole issue of words v explicitly in the introduction to one of his books.
Sure. And on
So.
that point, you see, Marjorie would often say this, that let the neck be free, to let the head go forward and up, to let the spine lengthen and the back widen, sending the knees away from the, sending the knees forwards and away. That was the nearest FM thought he could get in words to what couldn't be put in words. And so Marjorie Barlow very clearly did respect those four directions, those four orders. To let the neck be free, to let the head go forward and up, to let the back lengthen and widen while sending the knees forwards and away. Now, the conclusion of this conversation for me is that the one difference that I recognise that does seem to be difference is in Marjorie Barlow's attitude to those words. And here's why I think she was wrong, Robert, to depart from those four. Based on my own experience. Because we spoke last time we spoke, I told you about that my head of training, Ray Evans, thought the reflexes were important. Now, that comes from Walter Carrington, because when Ray finished his training, he asked Walter's advice on how to sort of continue developing. And Walter said two things. He said, first of all, Ray, slow down. And second of all, this work has got to do with the reflexes. So if you want to, because Ray was an engineer, he said, if you want to sort of understand the engineering aspect of it, look into reflexes. So my Alexander head of training, Ray Evans, found out about these so-called primitive reflexes. And he recognized they were important. And I, having the kind of mind I've got, I wanted to sort of find out all about those. And try to talk to the likes of Marjorie Barlow about them. But Marjorie was not interested. She just kept bringing the discussion back to let the neck be free, to let the head go forward and up, to let the back lengthen and widen, sending the knees up to the ceiling. So for me, and also she, after I kind of took over Ray's mantle on an Alexander training course for being the guy who would talk to the students about the reflexes. But as I was doing so, I felt a real conflict within me that here was I talking about this kind of abstract scientific knowledge, knowing that Marjorie would not approve of that kind of talk being going on a training course where she thought the whole emphasis should be on saying no, giving the orders, going to movement. And so for years, I struggled with that until finally the penny dropped in such a way I thought, how has it taken me so long to realize that the simple point is that the four vestibular reflexes that I'm particularly interested in each correspond to the four Alexander directions. So to let the neck be free is a preventive direction for the baby panic reflex. When FM talks about unduly excited fear reflexes, that's the reflex he's talking about. The head to go forward is preventing the hyperextension part of the balance reflex, and up is to prevent the flexion aspect of the balance reflex. So neck free, head forward and up are an inhibitory direction for the Moro reflex and the tonic labyrinthine reflex, to put it in those terms. Then back to lengthen and widen is a preventative direction for the shortening and narrowing that takes place when the body twists, which is to do with the asymmetrical tonic neck reflex. And finally, knees to go forwards and away is a direction to prevent being stuck in the grip of the symmetrical tonic neck reflex. So this is my thing, Robert, the four Alexander directions each correspond to one of these vestibular reflexes, balance related reflexes, which are the four cornerstones of all human behavior. So that's why I think that Alexander thought the four directions were important. So I don't know what you make of that.
Well, that's an interesting point. Obviously, you know, having seen Marge's directions in action and see them working pretty well for most people, I guess my initial reaction would be, yeah, the words are different and the approach is a little different, but I think to a certain extent, her directions dealt with the same reflexes that you're talking about, perhaps in a slightly different, maybe a more indirect way, I don't know. But one thing about Marge that I think most people probably are not so familiar with about her is that she would, from time to time, work with people who had severe learning disabilities or small children who were brought in with problems, or even occasionally adults who were not actually very capable of thinking in the Alexander sense of the word.
Yeah.
And in those cases, Marge would revert to pretty much pure hands-on work with very little talking, and the results would be astonishing sometimes. And actually, at the very end of her life, the last year, year and a half, when she was very, very weak in some ways physically, in fact, had to have a home health aide stand behind her to make sure she didn't fall over backwards when she was standing. So she was about 94 at that point. She would work with people, no longer in groups, but individually, typically, for quite long periods of time, and it was all hands-on and very little talking. And it was and I was fortunate enough to be around during that period and to have quite a few sessions with her during that period. And it was the most amazing experience I'd ever had, Alexander-wise, because she was basically talking directly to my nervous system, and bringing about huge changes that I'm sure are related to the, at least in part, to the reflex things that you're talking about.
Sure.
So she was very, very capable of departing from her normal teaching routine. I think the thing about Marge is that she just liked working with young people particularly, and she liked working with large groups. That's what she liked to do. She didn't really table work was really not her thing when I knew her. Not that she wasn't able to do it, but she just wasn't interested in it.
Marjorie Barlow, I got the impression, you know, I used to drive down from Aylesbury to London on my motorbike to see her. I got the impression she really enjoyed doing the work.
Marge Barstow, but she didn't enjoy table work particularly. I mean, she would do it if needed, but she loved being with a group of young people. And she was a party girl. I mean, when the class was over, she wanted to go out and have dinner with the group and see a play or go to a concert. I mean, she wanted to be part of the whole thing. She didn't just retire back to her house. Mm-hmm. She was a party girl. She really liked to be out and about, and she was always observing people and making interesting comments about people. So maybe this would be a good place to end. We might want to revisit the two Marges if there's enough interest. But maybe this would be a good place to bring this conversation to an end. What do you think?
Well, I could go on forever, Robert. But
both could. And you know what?
The one thing I'd like to come back to, maybe, you know, a future interview would be great, would be why Marjorie Barlow thought the four directions were so important, you know. Mm-hmm. Because she absolutely did. She used to, with gusto, go through the four again and again and again, you know.
Right.
Including knees up to the ceiling if you were lying on the table.
Right, yeah. Well, let's end this conversation here. My name is Robert Rickover. I'm an Alexander teacher in Lincoln, Nebraska, and in Toronto, Canada. And I've been speaking with Mike Cross, who's an Alexander Technique teacher in Aylesbury, England, between Oxford and London. And we've been talking about the two Marjories, Marjorie Barlow, who Mike has been talking about a lot, who is Alexander's niece, and Marjorie Barstow, who was pretty much a lifelong resident of Lincoln, Nebraska, and who was on, both women were on Alexander's first training course, and both are pretty well known, I would say, in the Alexander world. If you want to learn more about Marjorie Barlow, there is a website, marjoriebarlow.com, and her name is spelled MARJORIE, Marjorie Barlow. And for Marjorie Barstow, there isn't really a website devoted to her, is there, Mike, that you're aware of?
Well, I think yours is the best one, Robert, isn't it?
I don't know that I have a lot of information about Marjorie Barlow.
Marjorie Barlow is, the spelling, by the way, of Marjorie Barlow is with a Y.
MARJORY.
That's Marjorie Barlow, mm-hmm.
And there are some CDs available of her teaching and speaking, I believe. Marjorie Barstow, there are a lot of video clips of her on YouTube. You can just do a YouTube search or just go to the website I mentioned.
So there's a wonderful book we might mention of Marjorie Barlow's called An Examined Life, written with Trevor Allen Davis.
Yes, an excellent book. I highly recommend that book. And Marjorie Barstow wrote relatively little, but the little she did write was pretty interesting. She wrote the introduction to an American edition of Use of the Self, but she was not a writer particularly. So I think on that note, we could end this conversation right now.
Mike, thanks, Robert.
Mike, thanks so much for engaging in this conversation.
A pleasure.
Take care.